It is Friday, February the 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, a controversial Russia probe memo might be released today by the White House. President Trump speaking before a retreat of congressional Republicans.
Every day we're removing government burdens and empowering our citizens to follow their hearts and to live out their dreams. The priorities of Republicans in Congress are the priorities of the American people.
And we've heard that Iran won't be limiting its influence in the Middle East, plus female equality in the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. A White House official says President Trump plans to approve the release of a classified memo alleging top law enforcement officials were biased against Mr. Trump. The official says the president is okay with it and would likely inform Congress on his decision sometime later today. The official said it would likely be released without any editing at all. President Trump is at odds with both the Federal Bureau of Investigation, that's the FBI, and the Justice Department over whether to make the memo public. Few people outside of Congress have read the so-called Nunes memo, named for the Republican congressman who drafted it. It allegedly includes details about Justice Department efforts before the 2016 U.S. presidential election to seek authority from the Federal Intelligence Service Court, surveillance court that is, to monitor a Trump campaign advisor's possible contacts with Russian operatives. Democrats and other critics of the memo say it selectively uses classified intelligence to allege the Russian investigation is affected by political bias. The partisan dispute also has drawn in the FBI. The Bureau has issued a highly unusual public statement saying that it has grave concerns about the accuracy of the memo. International Edition's Lori London speaks now to former prosecutor and CIA officer and currently a criminal defense attorney, Jack Rice, about the memo.
What is the big deal about it, and why are Republicans so anxious to get it out in the public and Democrats and apparently the FBI not so keen on that happening?
Here's the problem. Some are characterizing this as a memo from the House Intelligence Committee. It's not. It's actually a memo from Congressman Nunes's own people. So in other words, it's something that they drafted specifically to drive one point, and that's to undercut the credibility of the FBI, because that's actually what it's designed to do. I think the FBI has said that very clearly. They're even saying that this could damage national security. And yet, strangely enough, Nunes and apparently the GOP and the president himself don't care. That is astounding, and I don't think I'm overstepping here.
How unprecedented is it for a president and a political party to go against the advice of the FBI when it comes to classified information being released?
This is really unprecedented. The reason it's unprecedented is because the way it's supposed to work is this. When a memo is issued to the public, what you're supposed to do is to take it to the organizations that had intelligence in it. So it could be the Bureau, it could be CIA, it could be NSA, it could be DOD, somebody, to make sure that there's nothing in there that could actually be tracked backward, that could actually hurt the United States. In this particular case, that simply was ignored. The FBI very clearly said, we need access to this. We need to scrub this clean so we make sure that we're actually protecting not just the people and the intelligence that we may have, but how we do what we do. And essentially, Nunes said, no. You know, what really should have been done is this. The purpose of this investigation is to determine whether or not, not just that the Russians actually tried to manipulate this election. They did. That is a question that has already been answered. The question is whether or not anybody in the Trump campaign was involved in colluding with the Russians. The issue isn't about trying to defend the president or trying to bury the president. The issue is to determine what exactly the Russians did and how close to the president they actually got. And what we're seeing right now is a fight, sadly, to try to diminish the evidence itself by the GOP, but in addition to that, to try to undercut the credibility of the investigation itself. Not because they're trying to dismiss the evidence. The biggest problem is that what they're actually doing is they're trying to undercut the credibility of the Bureau so they can dismiss the facts of the case. Hmm. And that's a really serious problem, because in the end, if there was criminal behavior inside the campaign, this is not a Democratic or a Republican question. This is an American question that needs to be answered. But right now, it's being treated as a political football, and it can't be.
What happens if the memo is released and it's not necessarily accurate and could be damaging? What happens then?
Two things. The part that I'm afraid of is what could happen to potential sources that the Bureau has that are out there, and whether those could dry up. In addition, how they actually acquire the information that they have could be used by foreign intelligence services, by rogue elements like terrorist groups. That issue that's out there that needs to be concerning. But the other piece of this, my biggest concern is that the reason Nunes is releasing this memo is to convince the American people to ignore the Russia investigation. That's what I'm afraid of.
In other words, you think that somehow this memo, which apparently is not necessarily accurate according to the FBI, the president seems to think it will vindicate his position that this Russia investigation is just simply a waste of time?
At least at this point, here's what we know. The president has fired an FBI director, has been trying to push out his assistant, has been talking about trying to push out the special counsel who was doing the investigation itself, has reached back into justice and said, why aren't these my people? He's looking for loyalty. He's seen this from the second in command there. Over and over and over again, what he has tried to do is he's tried to make this investigation go away. The real question in my mind is that, look, if you're innocent, let it play out. It'll prove that you didn't do it. Instead, what you're trying to do is crush it and push it away and to diminish it, rather than saying, come on, open the doors. Let's see what we've got. Let's get this done so we can move on. He's done everything but that.
That is criminal defense attorney Jack Rye speaking with my colleague, Lori London. No doubt lots of people are using social media to express their thoughts about the so-called Nunes memo, that is. VOA's Doug Bernard is here now with what's happening. What do you have there, Doug?
People are obviously talking a lot about this. What they're saying, however, differs. We may have mentioned briefly, by the way, I just wanted to restate. The hashtag release the memo was sort of picked up or scooped up last week by a whole trove of Russian bots. And a lot of research has been conducted. And basically, that has been sort of corrupted. Everybody who's using that hashtag now is kind of pretty much suspect of not even being a real person. So there are other ways to search in social media, but I just think entering memo is going to do it. Adam Schiff here, who's the ranking Democrat on the committee, tweeting out, discovered last night that Chairman Nunes made material changes to the memo he sent to the White House, changes not approved by the committee. The White House, therefore, reviewing a document the committee has not approved for release. Eric Holder, the previous attorney general, here tweeting out, people must understand what is at stake by release of the bogus, contrived Nunes memo. It uses normally protected material and puts at risk our intel capabilities in order to derail a legitimate criminal investigation. This is unheard of. It is dangerous and irresponsible. Here is Charlie Daniels. Charlie Daniels, the country musician. Damn the leadership of the FBI and the State Department. We, the people, have a right to know what they've been up to. This nation does not belong to the government. It's ours. And when that ceases to be so, we're no better than your garden variety banana republic. So a lot of people sharing their thoughts.
No doubt, Doug. Many thanks. VOA's Doug Bernard. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. An advisor to Iran's supreme leader says the country has no intention of limiting its influence across the Middle East. Ali Akbar Velayati is quoted by the Fars news agency as saying Tehran's presence in Syria, Iraq, Palestine, and Lebanon is in coordination with those governments. Earlier, a senior U.S. official expressed alarm at Iran's proliferation of missile technology to regional proxies such as the Houthi rebels in Yemen and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Acting U.S. Assistant Secretary of State David Satterfield told the Tel Aviv-based Institute for National Security Studies Tehran seeks dominance in the region, that a destabilized Syria with a shared border with Israel presents Iran an opportunity to exploit.
We will sustain our efforts to support legitimate state security institutions in Lebanon, such as the Lebanese Armed Forces, which is the only legitimate military force in Lebanon and could well serve as a counterweight to Hezbollah's desire to expand its own influence there, as well as Iran's reach in Lebanon.
But Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman, speaking through an interpreter here, told the same conference Lebanon and Hezbollah are one and the same.
While the strategy has not been formally endorsed, I can say that it is the accepted wisdom today among policymakers in Israel. The crux of this policy is holding Lebanon, the host state, responsible for what the messenger Hezbollah does. We will no longer agree to the artificial separation between Hezbollah and Lebanon.
Lieberman warned another war with Lebanon would result in a massive rocket strike on Israel and amount to a declaration of war by Lebanon, which would pay the full price. Michael Fishbach, a Middle East scholar at Randolph-Macon, tells VOA's Victor Beatty there has long been concern about the sizable influence Hezbollah has in the security and political life of Lebanon.
Certainly under the Lebanese system, Hezbollah forces, along with the Lebanese army, are together considered two legitimate arms of the defense establishment in the country. So it certainly is fair to say that because of its role in the government and the presence of its military forces, that Hezbollah has a cozy relationship within the Lebanese state system. To say, as Avigdor Lieberman, the Israeli politician, that the two are indistinguishable is, I think, a far cry from reality. And it highlights ever more so the strange situation in which the United States has found itself, which is that however much it may not like Iran or Hezbollah, both of those forces, along with other Shiite and Alawi forces of the government of Syria, are in fact the ones who have really been beating back groups like ISIS in Syria. So one of the great ironies is that for all of the vitriol and the rhetoric between both Washington and Tel Aviv about Iranian intentions and Hezbollah's influence in the region, they are all, in a sense, allied in their common fight against Sunni extremists like ISIS. And so seeing these kinds of flare-ups of disagreement is strange, but in fact, on one level, not unusual, given the realities of the situation presently in the Middle East.
How likely is a conflict between Hezbollah in Lebanon and Israel?
Well, it's always looming. It's one of those situations, in a sense, although for very different reasons, but in a sense, it's always like a potential war between Israel and Hamas forces in Gaza. It's always a potential, and both sides have taken great pains over recent years to prepare for the next round. That's not to say that conflict would be imminent. And in the case particularly of both Hezbollah and Israel, both sides recognize that there would be great cost to civilians, to infrastructure, if there ever is a next round. even just in the last 24 hours, Israeli military officials have said, if Israeli civilians are ever forced to go into air raid shelters again because of Hezbollah, then, quote, all of Beirut will have to take shelter.
Michael Fischbach also told us that Israel views Hezbollah as a greater threat than the Islamist group Hamas in Gaza. The meeting in Tel Aviv took place as Washington designated the Hamas leader a specifically and specially designated global terrorist. The U.S. already considers Hamas a terrorist organization. Public opinion polls indicate that President Trump's first State of the Union address this week got a generally positive response from viewers. The president emphasized unity and bipartisanship in his speech, which pleased many Republicans but left Democrats skeptical about his true intentions as well as the road ahead. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more.
The President of the United States!
After a tumultuous first year in office, President Trump used his State of the Union to make an appeal for unity before a joint session of Congress and a worldwide audience.
All of us together as one team, one people, and one American family can do anything. We all share the same home, the same heart, the same destiny, and the same great American flag.
Republicans welcome the president's softer tone and his appeal for bipartisanship, including Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick.
He talked about paid family medical leave. He talked about infrastructure. He talked about workforce training. He talked about opioids. These are all bipartisan issues, and I was really, really happy to see him strike that tone.
But throughout the speech, Democrats often withheld their applause, signaling doubt that Trump was sincere. Many Democrats also question whether the president is truly willing to compromise on immigration, including Congressman Jim McGovern.
This president's views on immigration are extreme. I mean, they appeal to a narrow, bigoted, racist element of his base.
Instant polls following the speech suggested the president's softer tone was at least initially effective. The question is, will it last? Analyst John Hudak.
If the president does want a reset, he's going to have to show that behavior more than just for an hour and a half, one night in January. He's going to have to continue to do that. And we have no evidence that Donald Trump has the capacity to change his behavior, not just in the long term, but even in the medium term.
It is now up to Trump to build on any momentum from his speech, says Jim Kessler.
Yeah, he should get a bump with the State of the Union. That happens with almost any president. The question is, you know, how long does it last? What is the shelf life, the half-life on that speech? Does it help him for 7 days or does it help him for 7 months?
Trump's speech left little doubt that his political base remains loyal to him. The president's challenge now is to find a way to broaden his support in the face of historically low approval ratings. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
President Trump continued his efforts to bring the Republican Party together by speaking before their annual Republican congressional retreat that happened Thursday in the state of West Virginia, where he spoke about the party's successes during his first year in office.
Every day we're removing government burdens and empowering our citizens to follow their hearts and to live out their dreams. The priorities of Republicans in Congress are the priorities of the American people. We believe in strong families, and we believe in strong borders. We believe in the rule of law, and we support the men and women of law enforcement. We believe every American has the right to grow up in a safe home and attend a good school and have access to a really great job. And we know that for Americans, nothing, absolutely nothing, is out of reach. Because we don't know the meaning of the word quit. We don't quit. And the Republican Party certainly hasn't quit. Because if we did, we wouldn't be here today. We'd be sitting home saying, boy, that was a tough year. Instead of that was one of the greatest years in the history of politics, in the history of our country for a party, what we've done and what we've accomplished. I don't think it's been
done, and certainly not by much. We had a year that was almost, I would think, unlike any. It was a tremendous success, and I give everybody in this room the credit.
President Trump also warned Republican lawmakers against labeling hundreds of thousands of young immigrants who are facing deportation as dreamers, as their advocates call them, while trying to keep them from returning home to their native countries. Mr. Trump said he hopes that Congress will reach an agreement to protect nearly 2 million young immigrants from being deported, part of a program created under former President Barack Obama, but accused Democrats of politicizing contentious immigration issues while not seriously trying to resolve them. The president also sent condolences to the family of the truck driver who was killed Wednesday when his truck was struck by a train carrying the Republicans to their retreat. No one on that train was seriously injured, according to the train officials, although Representative Jason Lewis and several others were taken to a hospital with minor injuries. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Watching astronauts float in the weightlessness of space may look like a lot of fun, but scientists have found that such an environment can also have negative physical and psychological effects on humans. German scientists say they have found another effect of weightlessness. It can produce a higher body temperature. Detailing their findings in a new study published by the journal Scientific Reports, the scientists found that after being in space for about 2.5 months, an astronaut's body temperature, on average, rose to about 38 degrees Celsius, 1 degree above a normal reading of 37 degrees, even while at rest. Lead researcher Dr. Hans Christian Gunga, a space medicine specialist, explains that it's really difficult for our bodies to rid themselves of excessive heat in the weightless conditions such as those experienced by astronauts. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Gender equality has long been an issue in the music industry, and the topic has surfaced again following the recent Grammy Awards ceremony. VOA's Jim Stevenson finds out more from Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald about a petition being circulated by singer Vanessa Carlton.
Making my way downtown, walking fast, faces pass and I'm homebound.
What we're talking about today is Neil Portnow, president of the Recording Academy, is in a bit of hot water.
Uh-oh.
Over some remarks he made following the Grammy Awards. Vanessa Carlton, the artist, you might remember her from some hit records she's had, she has a petition calling on Neil to step down as president of the Recording Academy. The petition has reached its initial target of 10,000 signatures. It's now past 12,000. It has got a new target of 13,000, and how it all began was on Sunday after the Grammy Awards, the 60th annual Grammy Awards. Critics of the Grammys decried lack of female representation among the awards. The only award of the night featuring a female recipient was Alessia Cara, winning Best New Artist. In fact, only 9% of the 899 Grammy nominees in the last six awards were women. Hmm. Portnow initially responded that women needed to step up to be part of the music industry on an executive level, and female artists immediately weighed in that women have been stepping up since the beginning of time, and that female artists are more relevant and creative than they have ever been, and that they are being underrepresented. Perhaps Portnow should step down, they said. Portnow has been heading the Academy since 2002. Speaking to the New York Times on Tuesday, Portnow clarified his position. He said his comments were taken out of context, and he said they do not convey my beliefs and the point I was trying to make. He said the music industry should recognize that women face unique barriers that men do not, and that we must actively work to eliminate those barriers, and that he remains committed to making the music industry safer and more inclusive. Now, of course, the Me Too movement was very much in evidence during the Grammys, as I'm sure it will be in evidence during the Academy Awards. I really wonder if Neil Portnow is going to survive this particular onslaught of criticism. His remarks really seem to have touched a nerve, And, of course, it goes much deeper than just underrepresentation for awards. Mm-hmm. Instances of sexism have been rampant in the music industry for as long as anyone can remember. And with all of these things coming to light now, his remarks were, you might say, unfortunate.
In this day and age, any remarks are going to be quickly transmitted to everyone and magnified
under the microscope
as a result. So you really have to watch what you're saying, and perhaps they were taken out of context, perhaps not. That's for everyone to decide who's involved.
Yep. So this is still very much a developing story as far as Neil Portnoy and the Recording Academy are concerned.
Coming to light each and every week is the Top 20 Countdown List. You'll want to stay on top of it with Ray McDonald on VOA 1. Also follow him on Twitter.
Catch me at Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Hold you tonight.
Vanessa Carlton, beautiful voice, huh? One last story. The world's longest zip line, accelerating thrill seekers as fast as 120 kilometers per hour, is open for business now at the United Arab Emirates' highest peak. Guinness Book of World Records affirming the zip line, which is 2.8 kilometers long, and the equivalent of more than 28 soccer fields, beats the previous 2.2 kilometer long zip line in Puerto Rico. Here are a couple of the zip line riders.
That was amazing. Nothing, guy. I've never felt this way before.
That was amazing. It was amazing. Don't know. Concentrate on the fantastic view.
What do you think? It's amazing, huh? No doubt, yeah. And, of course, it went fast. I've been on a zip line once. I think it went about 50 yards, so, you know, not very fast. World's leading zip line operator, Turo Verde, is, and its partner put this one up, took them 4 months, 200 riders daily on this particular zip line. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdul-Rahman, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a super Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction in any country of any individual who committed, conspired to commit, or aided or abetted in the commission of the murder of U.S. citizen Joel Shrum. On March 18, 2012, Shrum, 29, was shot and killed on his way to work in Taiz, Yemen, by a gunman riding on the back of a motorcycle that had pulled up alongside his vehicle. At the time of his death, Shrum was an administrator and English teacher at the International Training and Development Center, one of the longest-standing international development organizations in Yemen. A few days after the attack, the terrorist organization Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula claimed responsibility for the murder. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. You can follow Rewards for Justice on Twitter, at @rewards4justice. More information about the Shrum Reward offer is located on the Rewards for Justice website at www.rewardsforjustice.net. Anyone with information on this case can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website, email info@rewardsforjustice.net, phone 1-800-877-3927 in North America, or mail Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.